Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about the life of Mary Surratt. Now, I expect that today, probably, for a lot of people here in the United States, that name doesn't have any particular significance. But certainly, in the summer of 1865, just about everyone in the United States knew who Mary Surratt was. That summer, she was sentenced to die for her role in the plot to kill Abraham Lincoln, and she was, in fact, executed, becoming the first woman ever to be executed by the U.S. government. Now, it seemed that there were many Americans, particularly Northerners, who believed fully in her guilt and believed that she should be punished. Others, particularly Southerners, though, saw her as an innocent victim of the vengeful Union. In this hour, we'll be talking about the life of Mary Surratt with Kate Clifford Larson. She's an historian. She teaches at Simmons College, that's in Boston, and she is the author of The Assassin's Accomplice, Mary Surratt and the Plot to Kill Abraham Lincoln. The book is published by Basic Books. If you'd like to look at it, go out and find it in the bookstore or the library. She also has put a lot of her scholarly energies into researching the life of Harriet Tubman, and she is also the author of biography Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing, as I usually say here at this point, the only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Well, Dr. Larson, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Great, thank
good.
You.
Good, well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think it's interesting that you have chosen to look into and write about the lives of these two women from the same period. I don't know that you could find two people that were more at polar opposites, I think, in a way than Mary Surratt and Harriet Tubman.
I think you're right about that.
what was it that got you particularly interested in Mary Surratt?
Well, I had stumbled upon the website of the museum that is located at her former tavern in Clinton, Maryland, and I read about her life, and I was intrigued because I'm a women's historian, and I thought, well, this is a fascinating story, and I thought by reading about her at that time that perhaps she had been innocent and that she had been railroaded by the government and that she had been executed wrongly, and I just became very intrigued by her and her story. So that's why I pursued it. And, of course, I came to an entirely different conclusion.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting on a variety of levels. It's interesting just because of her personal story. It's interesting to look at how things played out. Also because I'm sure, offers some sort of insight into how at the time people thought about women and what their role was and how they should be treated. And particularly in her case, you know, what do you do with someone who is accused of a serious crime? You know, what sort of punishment would be suitable, appropriate, and would be sanctioned, generally speaking, by society?
Right. And it's also very revealing about the conflicted notions that people had about women. And on the one hand, there was this great desire to punish her and to create her or to sort of portray her as this monster. At the same time, everyone was really uncomfortable with that because, you know, women were delicate and they didn't do bad things and they were, you know, supposed to be accorded this sort of genteel image and treatment. And so it just kind of was a very difficult time for people to absorb all of this horror and this woman who perpetrated part of this, you know, horrific assassination. And so it was just a very complicated time period, and all these emotions and feelings played out in this one woman's story.
Yeah, it's something that I'm sure we'll talk about some more, particularly when we get to the point of the story of talking about what happened at the point where she was tried and executed. But it seems that even that there was, understandably so, in America, particularly in the North, there was a lot of anger about the assassination of President Lincoln. And people, I'm sure, felt that all of those who were involved should indeed be caught, tried, and perhaps all of them should be executed. And there was this great anger focused on the people who were accused. But it seemed that, and that was certainly directed toward her, but it seemed that almost as soon as she died, people started to have something of a change of heart, or at least started to think differently. And you begin, maybe even among those in the North, to have people who said, well, we're not sure, was this the right thing to do? Should she have been put to death? Maybe there were even people who were questioning the extent to which she was involved in the conspiracy.
Right. She had some supporters who were very effective in drumming up sympathy for her, particularly after the execution. And that played an important role in changing public opinion. But at the same time, I think deep down, most people never really expected the government to hang her. I think they all felt that at the last minute she would not be hanged. And when it happened, it was really quite stunning. And of course, people were still in a traumatized state after the assassination of Lincoln, the end of the Civil War, communities trying to rebuild themselves, and families, you know, were still fractured. And I think it was just a really difficult time, and to have this execution of a woman take place just kind of put people over the edge.
Yeah. Well, probably we start to know most about her at the point where she married Mr. Surratt, and then what her life was like that after that. But if you ask the question, well, how much do we know about her life as a girl, what her life was like up to the point where she married John Surratt?
There isn't a whole lot that we know about her, as we, you know, often don't know about any historical figure in their childhood and young adulthood. You know, certain famous men we know a lot more about. But she was, you know, a typical middle-class daughter of a southern slaveholding family, a widowed mother, and she had two brothers. And she was sent to Catholic boarding school and received a fairly good education as a young woman, which was not all that common, particularly in the South at the time. And so she was, you know, fairly privileged, not rich, but fairly privileged. And she met and fell in love with this young man who was several years older than her, John Surratt, and that's where her life starts on this trajectory that ends up in her horrific death, because he ends up being quite a difficult man, an alcoholic, a gambler, and her life with him was quite tumultuous. And so that shaped much of the way her life would go for the next 25 years after she married him.
It seems that it was to say the least, it was a troubled marriage, and it was a very difficult relationship. What more do we know, or do we know very much about what their relationship was like?
We do. She was very devoted to the Catholic Church and very close to several priests. And through some letters that she sent to these priests, we know that her marriage was very rocky. She sought solace and comfort from these priests, and her faith was a source of comfort for her. So, you know, we don't know all the everyday details, but we can imagine that with a drunken husband, it would have been a very unpleasant life. And if he had financial difficulties, it would have been a difficult time for them. And raising three young children with an alcoholic father would have been, you know, a very difficult thing. And in those days, there was no support system for women who were married to abusive or alcoholic husbands. So she was sort of on her own, and it must have been a difficult time for her.
Yeah. To make a living, they did a number of things. They certainly had problems. They had financial setbacks, and at some point they started the tavern, which would become an important location later on in the whole assassination plot.
Right. John had inherited a considerable amount of property outside of Washington, D.C. in southern Maryland, and over the years he sold it off or he lost it in gambling debts. But eventually he consolidated his finances, and he purchased a very important piece of property at a crossroads 12 miles south of Washington, D.C. that became known as Surrattsville, which is now known as Clinton, Maryland. And he built a tavern and a blacksmith shop, and it became a very important site because it was sort of in this very well-traveled route from Southern Maryland to Washington, D.C., and it was nominated as a postal office site, which was a very important thing to have happen to a tavern because it created more business, and it became a thriving tavern and location. And so I think Mary and her husband did quite well financially. However, he did gamble away some of their money and continued to drink heavily. And one historian did say that he was probably the tavern's best customer. Hmm. So it was still a difficult time for Mary.
Yeah. So apparently they did well enough that also one of the things that he did was he bought this house in Washington, D.C., the house, a house that still stands, and also that was very important to the sort of the development of the plot, because that's where a lot of the plot meeting involving the plotters took place.
Right. In 1852, he acquired a good size townhouse in Washington, D.C. on H Street, which is now it still exists, and it's a Chinese restaurant. He acquired it and he rented it out. He did not live there with Mary or his children, but eventually, of course, she would move into it during the Civil War. And as you said, it would become an important site for meetings with John Wilkes Booth to plot and plan against the president.
Yeah, that's a remarkable detail. I did see that, and I think I've actually seen photographs of what it looks like now, with the Chinese restaurant on the street level of the house. But I suppose it's good that the building does in fact still stand.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kate Clifford Larson. She's an historian. She teaches history at Simmons College. That's in Boston. And she is the author of The Assassin's Accomplice. It's about the life of Mary Surratt and her involvement in the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Basic Books is the publisher. Questions welcome here as we talk. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we talked a little bit about the marriage between Mary and John and their relationship and the tavern and the house in Washington. Perhaps then maybe the next big important turning point in her life came when John Surratt died.
Right. They had three children, two sons and a daughter, Isaac, Anna, and John Surratt Jr., and they had been off at boarding schools. Mary had been able to send them away and keep them away from the tavern and life there and their abusive father. But he died in 1862 in the early years of the Civil War. What is important to know here is that he had been a Confederate sympathizer. Although Maryland stayed within the Union, in southern Maryland in particular, many residents there, citizens, were sympathetic with the Confederacy, and they, you know, supported the Confederacy, and they conducted illicit activities in support of the Confederacy across the Potomac River in Virginia. And as the postmaster, he was in a perfect position to aid in messages back and forth between the Confederacy and spies living in Washington, D.C. and beyond. But when he died, that link and that support was gone. So Mary brought home her children to help her with the tavern, and John Surratt Jr. took over the role as postmaster. And that is when he became a rebel operative himself and a spy, taking over that role that his father had fulfilled at that time. And that began Mary's even more important role in these rebel activities and eventually her relationship with John Wilkes Booth. Mm-hmm. And the tavern was a very, very important spot, but the Union was watching the tavern because they knew that this could be a potentially important site for rebel activity. And in fact, many of the neighbors of the Surratts were arrested for conducting support of work for the Confederacy. And eventually John Surratt Jr. was arrested for being a spy and helping the Confederacy at the tavern, which placed the family at risk of losing their property. So it was a very tumultuous time for them during the Civil War.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that the tavern and the fact that it was a post office was really important for the people, for the Surratts, father and son, to be involved in this information network and of information people. That was this natural thing, and that then it passed from father to son. What exactly was it that they were doing, or what sort of information was it that was passing through there?
You know, I don't know the exact messages that were passed back and forth, but certainly it had to do with, you know, secret information that the Confederacy needed to know about Union movements, et cetera. And being so close to Washington, D.C., there were lots of spies in Washington, D.C. and New York and beyond. And there were Confederate networks that were being established in other big cities in the North and in Canada as well. And communication had to continue between these Confederate sort of strongholds in the North. And so those messages were passed by letter. They couldn't be passed through, you know, telecommunications like today. So they were messengers that were given the job to pass them through. And the post office had a secret system that was used to convey these letters back and forth. They were very clever about it, and it was very effective. So the Confederacy in Virginia, you know, had a very steady supply of information coming out of Maryland because there were so many Confederate supporters there. And in fact, Mary's oldest son, Isaac, joined the Confederacy early in the war, and she actually never saw him again.
Mm-hmm. This was perhaps another important turning point here for the fact that there was a lot of pressure on them that John Jr. lost this position. He was accused of being involved in this activity. He was at that point liable to be drafted into the Union Army.
Right.
At what point then was it? Were they forced to, in a sense, to? I don't know that they ever sold the tavern, but they turned it over to somebody else,
right?
To run it, and then they moved to Washington.
Well, John had, he was at risk of getting drafted into the Union Army, and he had been caught once, and I know they recognized that he could not be caught again, and it would put the tavern property at risk because the Union could confiscate it. So John was becoming more and more involved in Confederate spy networks, and he was a courier himself. He was starting to travel to other cities with messages. So Mary leased the tavern in the fall of 1864 to a John Lloyd and his family, and she moved her family to Washington, D.C., to the boarding house, which was then empty. And she furnished it and started advertising for boarders. One of John Surratt's school chums, Lou Weichman, moved into the home, and several other people, a family by the name of the Holohans, moved in. And by December, Mary had a full house. So it was up and running very quickly. But, of course, living in Washington, D.C. was a much easier place for John Surratt to conduct his spying because it's a crowded city. You're not going to be noticed so much. And also he could travel much more easily from Washington to Philadelphia, New York, Montreal, et cetera, and also secretly cross over the river to Richmond in Virginia. So he could really become much more involved in the Confederacy than he had been before. Mm-hmm. So it was a smart move for someone who was a Confederate sympathizer.
So for Mary, really, her connection to all of this, including the plot, really comes through her son, John Jr.
That's absolutely true. That's true. Although she was clearly open to any relationships. In December of 1864, John Surratt met John Wilkes Booth, and Booth had been traveling in and out of southern Maryland for months trying to encourage support for his scheme to kidnap Abraham Lincoln. And he had gathered a few supporters, and he was hoping to, you know, figure out a plan how he could capture the president and bring him through southern Maryland and have him taken across the river and held hostage in Richmond in return for the release of all Confederate prisoners in Union prison camps. So he had been sort of known in southern Maryland as he was trying to create his scheme. But John Surratt was an important person for him to meet because John was so well connected with the Confederate networks in southern Maryland. He was young, he was active, and he was very enthusiastic. So he and Bill Booth and Surratt hit it off very well, very, very quickly on. And within a couple of weeks, by the first of the new year, he had introduced Booth to his mother, and then John Wilkes Booth became a constant fixture at the Surratt boarding house from early January through the assassination on April 14th.
So is there reason to believe that one or the other, either John Surratt sought out Booth, or that it was the other way around?
It was the other way around, actually.
So Booth knew that here was a guy that he it would be good for him to know because of the kind of contacts that he had.
Right. And actually it was Dr. Samuel Mudd who introduced Booth and John Surratt. Mudd knew that Surratt could be very helpful to Booth, and he arranged the meeting. So here is another historical character that is part of this larger plot. And so it was Mudd that made the introduction in Washington, D.C., right before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. So maybe here, just to underscore another point, that initially the plot did not involve killing the president. The plot was to kidnap the president.
That's right. That's right. And it seems like a zany idea, considering how tall Lincoln was, and it would be very difficult to capture and take someone like that. But Booth believed that he could capture the president, who often was not very well guarded. It wasn't like many presidents had been threatened or assassinated before. So he thought he could get away with it if he had the right group of people. And through John Surratt, he had actually collected a small group of supporters who he thought would be perfect to help him capture the president at whatever time they tried to figure out would work the best, get him through southern Maryland and over the river into Richmond. So each person that joined the plot after John Surratt came on board had a specific role in that kidnapping scheme.
So here, I suppose the question, and it was a question I guess at the time people wrestled with, was just how involved Mary Surratt was with all of this, and was it simply the case that she was operating this boarding house where a lot of the conspirators passed through or stayed, and certainly her son was very involved. So the question is, well, was it, as I think it was Mr. Johnson, who had been the vice president, said, well, she was the keeper of the nest in which the plot was hatched. Was it was it sort of that kind of association, or was she more deeply involved in a real kind of material sense with the nuts and bolts of this plot?
Some people believe that she was involved only in that it's like guilt by association. But, of course, it's clear that she was not. She did provide a warm and welcome home for Booth and the other conspirators where that they could plot and plan. And there is no way in that boarding house that the meetings could take place and Mary not know what was going on. But her real complicity began after the Civil War basically ended with the burning of Richmond and then the surrender of Lee to Grant on Palm Sunday in April of 1865. And Mary became much more actively involved in material support and actively going out and doing things at Booth's request to support his plan to eventually kill the president. So up until April, she was there. She was supportive. She didn't tell the authorities what was going on. You know, she knew what was there. She was a Confederate operative herself, so she wasn't about to reveal anything. But the role in the final assassination, it was very real, and she took an active part, and that's why she was hanged.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, just let me introduce again, is Kate Larson. She is an historian. She teaches at Simmons College. That's in Boston. She is an authority on the life of Harriet Tubman and has authored a biography about her. That book is Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. And she also has a new book out that's about Mary Surratt and her involvement in the plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. The title of that book is The Assassin's Accomplice, and it is published by Basic Books. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So it was through her son that Mary Surratt came to meet and to know John Wilkes Booth. And I guess over time there has been some sort of speculation about exactly what the relationship was. I don't know that anybody thought that it was actually anything more than, let us say, close but not intensely close.
Right.
He was somebody, certainly if you look at his photographs, the man was very handsome and he was apparently very charismatic fellow.
Right.
And I guess there's also maybe some suggestion that at the very least that Mary Surratt's daughter had strong feelings about Mr. Booth.
Yes.
Is there what do we know about the relationship between Booth and particularly Mary Surratt and her daughter?
Well, we know from court testimony and eyewitnesses that lived in the home that Anna Surratt certainly had romantic feelings for John Wilkes Booth. However, they were not returned, as far as anybody could tell. But Mary, although I doubt that there was a physical relationship between Booth and Mary, people who lived in the house said that Booth and Mary often met privately in her room. So clearly they had discussions, and he was much younger than she was, and I am sure that she was a very supportive woman who listened to his schemes and his ideas, and you know, she was very warm and loving, and I'm sure he found great solace and support in her household and in her company. And as a result, you know, they trusted each other, and she evidently was willing to do anything for him because that's what she did, and she died for it. But I don't think there was any physical relationship between them. However, it is interesting that when she was asked during her interrogations, you know, didn't you think it was odd that John Wilkes Booth kept coming to your house? Because basically, as another historian had pointed out, you know, here's the most famous actor in the United States coming to this middle-class woman's boarding house all the time. Isn't that a little odd? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, Brad Pitt coming to my house frequently, and I don't even know him. It would just kind of raise some eyebrows. So, but she never thought that there was anything peculiar about that. And people thought that was disingenuous on her part, that clearly there was something going on and she was not admitting it.
We talked just a moment or two ago about the fact that initially the plot that was hatched by Booth and all these other people, initially the plot called for kidnapping the president, Mr. Lincoln, and then holding him hostage and using that as leverage to get release of all of the Confederate soldiers that were being held prisoner by the Union. And that at some point, it was a very complicated plot and involved a lot of people. And it was they were supposed to when he was going out riding one day, they were in his carriage. They were supposed to kidnap him at that point, and it sort of fell apart because at the last minute he changed his plans and didn't go out.
Right,
and that sort of scuttled the whole thing. So then, one of the questions I'm sure that a lot of people have looked at is at what point did Booth change his plan from kidnapping the president to murdering the president? And was that something that he discussed with Mary?
Well, I believe on the day of the assassination he did discuss it with Mary. But historians don't know exactly when Booth had decided to change his plan from kidnapping to assassination. After April 9th, when the war was over, there was no purpose to kidnapping the president because these Civil War soldiers, the Confederate soldiers, would have been released from the prisons anyway. So from at least the 9th on, he was clearly thinking of something else. Mary had gone to Surrattsville a couple of times before April 14th to check on some guns and other items that had been stored at her tavern that were there purposely for Booth when he was going to stop on his way out of Maryland with the captured president. But after the end of the Civil War, the reason for having those items there made no sense. However, she made sure that they were still there. She discussed these guns and other items that were hidden in the tavern with her tenant, John Lloyd. She made sure that they were still there. She wanted the tenant to be aware that someone was coming for them soon. And in fact, on the day of the assassination, she rode out to the tavern and she talked with John Lloyd and said, "They will be needed tonight." This is April 14th. This is after the Civil War the truce has been called. So she must have known that something was up and that kidnapping the president would make no sense. She, in my mind, she had to have known that Booth was going to do the ultimate act and assassinate the president, and that he would need some place to hide out and stop on his way escaping from Washington, D.C. And she set the plan for that. She made sure that everything was ready for Booth. So in my mind, she knew that something was up, and I believe she knew that Booth was going to assassinate the president.
Yeah, and apparently at the trial, this man Lloyd testified, in fact, that she had done this.
Yes.
Sounded like would have been a key piece of evidence of her involvement, and it would be, assuming that he was believed, it would be difficult for her to deny that she
had anything.
She said, I just had another reason to go out there. It really wasn't about this.
Right.
And the guy said, no. she came and she told me, you know, here you have these guns and they're going to be needed. And that seemed very clearly to indicate her, the depth of her involvement.
Right. And one of her boarders, Lou Weichman, was the one that brought her to Surrattsville several times during the month of April and also on that day of the assassination. And he also corroborated Lloyd's testimony that Mary kept asking to make sure that those guns and other items were ready. And, you know, she could not come up with a plausible explanation for that. So there was so much evidence against her. It's really astounding. And when you put it all together, I honestly cannot understand how anyone can claim that she was innocent, because it isn't just one person's testimony or even two. There were several people that testified that that really were very convincing, that showed that she was complicit in Booth's actions on that day of the assassination.
So suspicion would, if for those people who were investigating what happened to try to find out who was involved and so forth, that immediately suspicion would have been focused on her.
Actually, immediately suspicion focused on her son, John, who conveniently was in Canada most of this time, so he was not there on the day of the assassination. However, there was an event that happened very close to the assassination that sort of sealed her fate. The authorities showed up at her home within an hour or two after the assassination because they had received word that Booth had been seen at her boarding house with her son. And the authorities arrived at the house looking for Booth and John Surratt. They were not looking for any sort of evidence. They didn't find the two men, so they left. But 3 days later, they went back to the house because they had more and more information that was saying, you need to take a look at this house again. They go in and they start looking for material evidence, and they found some pretty odd things. But while they're there at 11 o'clock at night, there's a knock on the door, and who is it but one of the co-conspirators, Payne, who had tried to assassinate William Henry Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, the night that Lincoln was assassinated. And he had been hiding out in a cemetery for 3 days, and he was bloody and cold and hungry, and he had come to Mary for support and to, you know, hide out. And he knocks on the door while the police and the Union Army is there searching her house. So it was such damning evidence to have him come there at that particular moment in time. And even though she denied knowing Payne, he had been at her home several times, stayed overnight. She knew him very well, and other members of the household said that she did know him. So when she denied that she knew him, the police knew that they had some reason to suspect Mary. And from that point forward, she was on the walk to be hanged.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller to talk with, someone who is in DeWitt County. Let's talk with him on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. My eyes perked up, my ears perked up when I heard you mention Dr. Mudd being somehow more involved in this than what the history I've, you know, read and heard indicate. I just wonder if you could briefly cover just what was his role in this? Because I'd heard that he was some, you know, innocent bystander who just happened to fix a leg and got thrown in prison unjustly. And right. It sounds like there's more to it than that.
There's actually a lot more to it. Booth had spent time with Mudd in the fall of 1864, and in fact was in Washington, D.C. with him just before Christmas, where he met John Surratt, and he also met with Booth at some point in January as well. So this came out during the trial, and also eventually Dr. Mudd did admit that he knew Booth before the night that he arrived after the assassination to have his leg fixed. So Mudd, you know, the family has tried for a very long time to clear his name, but the evidence is overwhelming that Mudd knew Booth and knew him well before the assassination.
So he would have known not necessarily the assassination plot, but perhaps the kidnapping plot?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why Mudd was not hanged, because he actually was not part of, you know, the assassination attempt, but was, he did aid and abet Booth after the attempt, right. And he did not tell the truth to the authorities right away.
Okay, well, I feel better about him being in prison. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are certainly welcome. Again, our guest is Kate Larson. She teaches history at Simmons College in Boston. She's the author of the book, The Assassin's Accomplice. It's about Mary Surratt and her involvement in the plot to kill Abraham Lincoln. The publisher is Basic Books. Well, when she was put on trial, I could imagine, now we've talked a little bit about some of the evidence against her, which was significant, but I could certainly imagine in her defense making the argument that said, well, this would just, you know, this here, look at this woman. Does this look to you like the woman who would be involved in a heinous conspiracy to assassinate the president? No. We have a poor 40-year-old widow. She's a good woman. She was running a boarding house, and her only sin was to take in these dastardly conspirators. Yes, they lived under her roof, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she was involved in their plot or that she knew anything about it. I mean, that's the argument that I would make if I was going to defend her.
Right, right. But, of course, the prosecution presented the evidence that she knew what was going on, and they were very effective. But also the courtroom scene was very dramatic as well, and Mary didn't really help herself very much because she wore all black and a very heavy black veil so no one could see her face. So she created this sort of kind of mysterious but sinister persona about herself in the courtroom. And also, she ended up with attorneys that were totally incompetent. She had asked Reverdy Johnson, who was a senator from Maryland, an exceptional lawyer, to defend her. And he agreed, and the first day he came into the courtroom, he argued that the trial was illegal because it was a military tribunal and not a civilian court, and that was illegal because they were no longer at war. And once he made his argument, he said, if Mary Surratt were guilty, I would not represent her. And he left the courtroom and never came back. So that was very damning. And he sent two of his young, inexperienced lawyers in his office to represent her. And, you know, their defense has to go down in history as the worst defense in, you know, in the history of trials. They were just terrible, and everything they did supported the prosecution's argument. Every single thing they did, just, you know, and they kept bringing witnesses back to repeat their testimony that just damned Mary even more. It was nonsensical, and it was terrible. And actually, one person asked me if I thought that perhaps it was a setup, that they were determined to get her convicted, and that's why they gave her such a bad representation. I don't think so, but it is certainly something to ponder. But the fact that Reverdy Johnson said that he would not represent her if she was guilty and then left the courtroom and didn't show up till the very end was not a good thing for her.
All right, let's talk with some other callers. We have someone in Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What we know of alcoholism today and studies of families living with alcoholics, it seems to me that the woman wouldn't have had much common sense left after 25 years of living with someone like that. And her wearing black at the trial makes total sense, since she people like that often wear black because that's the way they are inside. Does that make sense?
You know, her mood, you know, it's the black and her mood certainly makes sense. However, she was a very, very smart woman. She was a capable businesswoman. She survived the death of her husband and didn't lose any of her properties, which was unusual for the time period. You know, she was a very smart woman, and I think that we fail sometimes to recognize that women are active agents on their own, and they can make decisions on their own, and sometimes they make really bad decisions and they do bad things. And I think Mary is a perfect example of this. And while she tried to portray herself as this poor widow who was being attacked by everybody in the courtroom, it also served to turn people against her, too, because they couldn't see her face. They couldn't see her pain, her worry, her tears. They just saw a black veil.
Yeah, I can understand that. But at that time, it would be very unusual for a woman to act on her own. But I'm wondering, you know, how much the need for attention and affection led her into some of this as well. I'm not saying that she was the poor, downtrodden woman that she portrays to be. I'm just saying, I wonder if it's possible that her brain was skewed in another direction.
Right. I think that Booth was certainly very persuasive and charming, but I have to give her credit for being her own woman, making her own decisions. And if what she did for Booth was rooted in her love for him, then that's the way it was. But, you know, she made conscious decisions, and she decided to help him, and she decided to lie to the authorities afterwards, and she sealed her own fate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can feel sorry for her, but at the same time, she did a terrible thing, and the president died because of it.
I'm not saying sorrow. I'm just trying to search for more of a motive than just being vicious.
Right. Well, but she was a Confederate sympathizer.
Mm-hmm.
She felt strongly about her way of life, and she did not want to see that happen, and she believed in what the Confederacy stood for.
Yeah.
And that was worth fighting for in her mind.
Well, thank you. You've painted a wonderful picture of her. I never knew all this, so thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Let us continue. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for the program. Very interesting. I tuned in late, and I might have missed it, but I wonder if you guest could clarify. Mary's son was tried later on and was acquitted, which I forget how that exactly happened.
Tell the story of what happened with
right.
John Jr.
So John Jr. Flees and hides in Canada throughout his mother's trial, and never steps forward to protect her or save her or anything. And he is protected by a Jesuit priest who get him off to Europe, and then it's like this madcap adventure trying to escape from U.S. federal marshals that are on his trail. Finally, he's captured in Alexandria, Egypt in 1867 and brought back to the United States and put on trial. The trial ends in a mistrial, and the government decides they should try him again, but then they discovered that the statute of limitations on treason or something had run out, and he could not be tried again, so he was set free. It's a remarkable story, because actually he's the one that should have hanged, I think, instead of Mary, but he didn't
hang
on to live.
I had read a fictionalized book that told the story from his point of view about the assassination and the lead up to that. It was very good.
Yeah. Well, he's a fascinating character.
And lastly, also, when John Wilkes assassinated the president and fled, I'll hang up after this, but what was his escape plan? I mean, how was he, with the war over and everything, how was he to, you know, how were these folks to get away with all this? And Mary being smart, like you said, I mean, left, you know, this trail was really led to her door and everyone's door there. I was wondering what how do they think they were going to get away with it? Thank you again, and thanks for the show.
All right.
Thank you. It's hard to imagine how they thought they would get away with it, but he, you know, for months, John Surratt and the other co-conspirators, along with Booth, had set a careful plan, and they had guns at the Surratt Tavern, and they had other contacts throughout southern Maryland that would help them get through marshes and bogs and forests, and they had a boat that they were going to use to get across the Potomac River. So they had all this stuff set up along this route out of southern Maryland, and it was still there on the 14th, ready for Booth, and that's what I think he was hoping to use. However, things got complicated, and ultimately he did get caught in Virginia. But, you know, he was thinking that this was all going to work perfectly and the Confederacy would protect him, even though the war was over. Booth was confident that there would be Confederate sympathizers that would help him.
Just for a moment to go back to John Jr., and as you've explained, at the time of the assassination, he was in Canada, and I think that there were some people who suggested that that one of the things that the government was hoping to achieve by putting Mary on trial was to force John Jr. to come back to the United States. And I'm sure or expect that there were probably a lot of people who were who at the time who would have been critical of him for not coming back to the country to try to do something to help his mother.
Right. There were a lot of people, and even today there are a lot of people who still believe he should have come back and that he was a terrible son not to do that. If the government believed that by holding Mary it would draw John out, you know, that's highly probable. However, to hang her, that's going a little too far. And the interesting thing is there were so many witnesses that testified against her when they easily could have substituted John Surratt's name for her name, and they did not. They said, Mary did this, Mary did that, she said this, she said that, when they could have said that it was all her son and not Mary. So I think Mary had her own individual guilt and involvement in the plot. And even though the government really wanted John to be tried as well, I don't think that them trying to draw him out affected their ultimate decision to hang her, that the evidence was overwhelming. By the end of the trial, they knew that they had someone who was deeply involved in Booth's plot.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them both. The next in line is in Urbana, in line two. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Larson.
Yes.
The biography of Andrew Johnson by Hans L. Trefus, I think that's how you say his name, said that when questioned, Andrew Johnson said that when he signed the death warrants for the conspirators, he wasn't feeling terribly well that day, and he actually didn't even remember specifically signing the death warrant for Mary Surratt. I wonder if that's part of the reaction to her execution.
That actually was a reaction to not only her execution, but also his political instability at the time. And he had many enemies, and he had some odd motivations at that time. But the historical evidence is very strong, and his cabinet members and other people said there is no doubt that Andrew Johnson saw that plea for clemency for Mary because she was a woman. And he told several people at that time that he did not believe she deserved clemency on the basis of being a woman, that you know, there were enough women who had caused problems during the Civil War, that she had done what she did and she deserved to hang for it. So there's no doubt that he did know that there was a clemency plea on the part of some of the justices in the court, but he decided, no, she deserved to die.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, and to another caller here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Right. There was a documentary on PBS which asserted that some of the main planning of the plot actually happened in Greenwich Village in New York City. Do you link this up in any way? Do you?
I know that John Wilkes Booth had contacts in New York City, and he was aware of other plots against Lincoln's life or against the White House, let's say, during that time period. But from my research, the plotting for the kidnapping with these particular conspirators and others that lived in Southern Maryland occurred at the Surratt boarding house and at restaurants and hotel rooms around Washington, D.C. But there were other connections around northern United States. In New York, Montreal, they were scheming there as well. So I'm sure there were other people aware of the plot, but the actual planning occurred there in Washington, D.C.
Booth was on this circuit. He was an actor, so he traveled.
Yes.
And there is this assertion that and New York was a major slave center through many years, and the moneyed interests.
Right.
So it just seems to me that there's this sense that it's part of the Civil War, and I'm not being very articulate here, but there are many centers that that opposed Lincoln and
absolutely. There were lots of people that questioned what was going on during the war in the North, and there were Confederate strongholds, particularly in New York City, which was not very anti-slavery, let's put it that way. And in Montreal, there was a strong Confederate cell there as well. And Booth needed to raise money, so he traveled to some of these little Confederate outposts and talked to people who were, sympathetic with the Confederacy to raise money. He needed money to make this plot work. He needed to pay people. He needed to buy horses and guns, etc. So I think there were a lot of people that were aware of his plot, and they were never uncovered. They were never brought to trial, and the eight that were brought to trial were very close to the plan, and they were centered around Washington, D.C. and Maryland because they were physically involved with the plot, not necessarily just financially involved. But the financial connections, I think, spread throughout the North into Canada as well.
We have just about a minute. And if you could talk that long about how it is after, in the years after her execution, people thought about her or perhaps changed the way that they thought about her.
It was pretty quickly after the war that sympathy really swelled for Mary Surratt and what happened to her. And it, as I had said in the beginning, it was partly due to these supporters of Mary's that sort of set up this marketing campaign to clear her image. And it lasted right through the early 20th century. And a lot of it was predicated on false information that they put out and historians who picked up that false information and propagated it throughout the 20th century. So it wasn't until the 1970s that people began to take another look at the assassination and Mary's role and begin to look at the original information and realize that Mary, probably was involved or possibly was involved. And there's been great scholarship in the past 30 years that has relooked at the assassination, and that research really helped me with my book and come to terms with Mary being guilty and involved in the plot to kill Lincoln.
Well, if people would like to read more about the story, the book to look for is The Assassin's Accomplice, Mary Surratt and the Plot to Kill Abraham Lincoln. It's published by Basic Books by our guest, Kate Clifford Larson. She's an historian. She teaches at Simmons College in Boston. And Dr. Larson, well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.